Let's hope we'll make it fun some of the times. Yeah. Okay. Technology extends the reach of man on the world. And we can intervene ever deeper into the construction and manipulation of this reality of this world. Culture gives meaning to the world. Culture is the stories we tell about ourselves, about who we are, but also about others and about mankind as a whole. Our self-constructed world is a technocultural construct that imprints itself deeply into our consciousness, while at the same time we produce the world from our consciousness. In this never-ending feedback loop, culture, technology, or technique are two sides of the same coin, two perspectives on our self-constructed world. Culture is about what our world is, technology about how she works. Monik is interested in how man, again and again, has to find a new relation to its self-constructed modern world. Progress and modernity bring along tragedy. When we search for the new knowledge, new insights, and new experiences, there is loss. At the same time, modernity is constantly trying to overcome and eliminate this loss. Mankind is not simply the adding up of experiences. The man-made world is so ubiquitous that in a certain sense, we are living in our own gilded cage, a technocultural bubble. Outside this bubble is nature, the uncultivated, something that we constantly seem to lose. Something that constantly regresses into a fog, becoming invisible, unattainable. Our relation with the future is deeply intertwined with our present. The title of today's event is telling in this respect, Failed Futures. Apparently, we have a plan for the future, or at least we believed we do. How could it otherwise possibly fail us? Our thinking about the future is deeply modern, although it has been roughened up. We are not as naive anymore to believe in the dreams of progress that the early moderns had. We are horrified by the idea of engineering races, about wheeling people into the machinery of a totalitarian state, and skeptical about the trumps of science and technology. But our relation to the future is still distinctly rooted in modernity, although perhaps a darker, gloomier, and more nihilistic rendering of modernity. Somewhere in the early 80s, the shiny white future died and made place for the gritty, retrofitted present. Not Star Trek, but Blade Runner. No Lycra uniforms parading through clean corridors, operating flawless technology, but a hungover lone wolf in a scruffy jacket eating a bowl of street ramen in the pouring rain before he's recruited to hunt down some technology that went haywire. It's not even so much about the plot. The complete rendering of the future changes from the 1980s onward. The backdrop, the environment against which the narratives of science fiction play out, are like ours today. The neon might be glowing brighter and bigger there, and the towers might be darker and higher, but since then, the future started looking a lot like our present, or at least a present somewhere on our planet. What happened? What line did we cross? I think we crossed two lines. Two limits. One that delimits our outside as a human species, and the other that delimits our inside. One could say the outside of our collective consciousness and the inside limit, which comes closer and closer to our individual private consciousness. First, the outside. There was a time when the future wasn't so much another time as it was another place. Over the course of history, we've been pushing back the dark clouds of the unknown, the internal frontier that held promises of new worlds, new resources, and strange creatures. This frontier is gone. Promising horizons have been stitched together into a globe. Travel long enough and you'll just end up from where you left. But we hadn't reached that outer limit yet. Although we had a map of the conquered world on our wall and a globe in our study that promised adventures and travels into the exotic, a mapped world that could still be discovered. And it's so cool that I get a Indiana Jones in my In our collective consciousness, we reached the outer limit when the world saw this image in 1972, made by the crew of the Apollo 17 spacecraft. In this season's eighth episode of Mad Men, Pete Campbell voiced well the thoughts of his generation when he asks to Harry if he'd seen this image from Earth, from outer space. He says, "It didn't bother you to see the world tiny and unprotected, surrounded by darkness?" Although this image captures well this turn in global consciousness, the limits of our planet and the human species became apparent in more than one way. We were running our little spaceships in all the wrong ways. And we would head for disaster, collapse of the ecosystem, overpopulation. In other words, a planetary catastrophe. All of a sudden, the horizon had moved from the dimensions of space to those of time. Somewhere, this limit now lies somewhere in the midst of the 21st century. But this new horizon was no happy horizon. Behind the future could be our imminent demise. The other limit is the inside limit, that delimits the self, our identity, who we are. Marsha McLuhan talked about technology and media as extensions of man. We would extend our senses, our reach and communication. An entire globe would have the intimacy of a village. Our relationship with technology enhances us, but it doesn't intervene into the core of our humanness. Another lesser known media theorist, the German Friedrich Kietler, wasn't as optimistic. Technology changes us, it intervenes into the course of our existence, of what it means to be human. Media and technology have come pretty close. It is all but physically under our skin, but psychologically, it certainly is. The first symptoms of this started arising in the 19th century when schizophrenic patients started blaming something they would call an influencing machine for controlling their minds. These machines would always utilize the latest technology and scientific discoveries. Their workings were so complex that the patients would give detailed descriptions and drawings like this one. But they could not explain how the mysterious device actually worked. Viktor Tausk, a disciple of Freud, wrote a famous treatise on this affliction in 1919 and argued that these patients project all their shameful bits onto this non-human entity. The person's identity is undressed. Everything they cannot acknowledge as being them, they project on the influencing machine, Tausk wrote. Where the 19th century technology and science and mass media, this was the age when the newspaper became really big, were novelties in their own right, in the 1980s, this media and technology reached a stage where it got into every home and it got personal, very personal. The portable device, the Walkman, the camcorder. Also, everybody started recording, playing back, and creating their own media. This is the moment where the idea emerges that we can directly plug our minds into the machine. Listen to how William Gibson explains how he came up with the notion of cyberspace, a kind of mental space inside a machine.
But it's not just the word, it's the idea of a virtual reality inside computer network. Where did that come from?
My input for doing that was my experience of the very first Sony Walkman as a really intimate interface device that I could carry around. My observation of the body language of kids playing those early plywood-sided arcade games. I saw the kids playing those games and I knew that they wanted to reach right through the screen and get with what they were playing with there. And I thought, well, there's a space behind the screen and everybody's got these things at some level, maybe only metaphorically. Those spaces are all the same space. And as soon as I thought that, I had it.
Technology has come so close that its interface disappears. It is nesting itself in our mind's eye, and then we can start wonder. And then we can start to wonder, what is there? What is there deep down on the inside? Is there a self, a soul, a real me, if you go deeper and deeper? And if so, shouldn't we have some limits there? Limit our machines? Limits our machines are not allowed to cross? Technological progress asks us, what does it mean to be human? And do we need to protect it? Or perhaps we have to decide who we want, who or what we want to become. So you can argue we've reached these two limits, limits beyond which it is hard to see. William Gibson argues that the future with a capital F is over. What is left is the future with a small f. This newfound state of no future is, in my opinion, a very good thing. It indicates a kind of maturity, an understanding that every future is somebody else's past, every present somebody else's future. Upon arriving in capital F future, we discover it invariably to be the lowercase one. What is this kind of maturity Gibson refers to? What could this mean? How could we see the state of no future as connected to a notion of maturity? This is one of the notions we are researching within the Still City project. Our outer limits and inner limits came into view because we are racing towards them with our current growth paradigm. With the growth paradigm, I mean the deeply intertwined narratives of our economic, demographic, technological, and personal growth. Almost every graph showing any parameter of our world's history looks something like this. The hockey stick graph has become the icon of our time. We see it so often and in so many guises that we're almost becoming numb to it. In our project on stillness, we investigate what will happen with our society, economy, our culture, our cities, and our values when some of these parameters will start to disconnect from the exponential upward motion of this graph. What will happen with our society when the world's population stops growing, the economy goes into indefinite recession, and when we've reached the limits of the Earth's resources? We, by and large, have no clue where we're heading. It is crisis, big time, because we don't grow anymore, or at least our economy doesn't grow anymore, and this is the worst thing that could happen to any society, because when the economy doesn't grow, human lives lie in shambles. Our retirement, the dream house, a second child, a university education, your career. Practically all our personal narratives are interwoven with the grand economic narrative. All our hopes and dreams are speculations on growth. The end of the graph came into sight at the end of the 60s, early 70s, as I showed earlier with this series of books. Today, we are confronted with our fear for a new paradigm, the paradigm of stagnation, meaning that we will be living for a while with the frustration that we're not growing anymore. This paradigm of stagnation is dawning on us today. My generation will have to do with the same or less than my parents' generation. This probably counts for practically all of you in the room. This uncertain destiny evokes mixed emotions. Today we are fearful. We blame the other. We try to survive. We try to bend things, and we try to be positive, shrink as a chance, maybe. And we hope that all our innovation and technology, the vectors that still go up, will eventually save us somehow. In the Still City project, we are searching for this destiny, the paradigm after stagnation, after the frustration and loss of growth. We have named this new paradigm stillness. Perhaps it is similar to what Gibson refers to as a kind of maturity. The project is a kind of scenario exercise in which we research what change and growth will be without expansion, depletion, and exploitation. What could change and growth mean within an inclusive and sustainable context? What will happen to personal growth when we decouple it from economic growth? From all the utopian plans that I know, Constance's New Babylon, which you just saw, rings most true to me. in the sense that it's very close to the kind of trajectory we are on. It is not necessarily the architectural and urban form Constant gave to his utopia, but the ideas that underlie his scheme are spot on. New Babylon is a terminal destination of society. Technological progress has alleviated us from work. Our environment has become an infrastructure to the mind, to creativity, to play. In New Babylon, we will play till the end of our days. Of course, for Constant, being amongst other things also a Marxist, New Babylon was an utopia where he believed the labor class could be liberated from toil and exploitation. In Constant's scenario, the division of labor would progress towards the point that Homo Faber would be replaced by Homo Ludens. Constant's New Babylon mirrors in many ways the idea of the creative city, as formulated by Florida and Landry. In the developed world, we are aiming to become the Homo Ludens, or in today's terms, a knowledge worker or creatives. When the makers, the physical labor becomes too expensive and is outsourced overseas or overruled by automation, the creatives can breathe new life into the workshops of Homo Faber. Cities that were once thrusted upwards by an industry that in the meanwhile has left town and left its inhabitants behind. At least the employees that couldn't leave for another job, another place, another life somewhere else. Not everybody is as mobile, not everybody is as highly educated, is a highly educated worker that can find its way anywhere. Apparently, the low educated worker is exchangeable, but one should hold on to the highly educated worker. As a last resort to save Kodak, everything was done to keep the managers, because they would leave the ship first. Makers are replaceable. This is the problem of division of labor and how we value labor. Since we left our days of hunting and gathering behind us, our activities have become more and more diverse and specialized. To operate a modern, comfortable society, we can't all do the same. As Plato said, how will our state supply these needs? It will need a farmer, a builder, and a weaver, and also, I think, a shoemaker, and one or two others to provide for our bodily needs, so that the minimum state would consist of 4 or 5 men. Division of labor is thus necessary. If we don't want to return to a pre-industrial, even prehistoric situation, but the way we value labor and how we divide her is resulting into more and more friction in our society. There is an ever-widening gap between the high and the low educated. At the top of the labor pyramid is the creative class. They make the new images and symbols. They produce meaning and lifestyles that can be latched on to products and services. At the bottom of the pyramid are the low educated that keep the machinery of our society running. The relation to work of both these groups is radically different. Where the high educated person associates work with life fulfillment, for the low educated, it is a means of survival. Life fulfillment is looked for outside the workplace. In our Still City project, in our Still City project, we research what could happen with labor in the economy if the economy does not grow anymore. How we value labor has to do with how we divide her, how we educate, how we organize trade and production. The way we organize these things construct our truth about labor. Knowledge labor is better than manual labor. The VMBO'er, but like the lowest level in high school, feels that he or she experiences this inferiority. And please take note, 60% of the students in high school is a VMBO'er. So this is all but a marginal problem. Besides the creatives, we have also invested our hope for the future in innovation and technology. But alas, this will also offer little consolation, because technology, automation, takes more work out of our hands than it generates. In his books, Engines of Creation, The Coming Era of Nanotechnology, and Unbounding the Future, The Nanotechnology Revolution, Eric Drexler explains how by manipulation of matter at the level of atoms will generate a future of abundance. Everything could be made by assemblers that operate at the molecular level and for practically no cost. Visions of abundance are always invented by people that are involved with the creation of knowledge, stories, images, code, and other abstraction. Never by people who physically make things. Would the future vision of the knowledge worker, the creative, be just as tempting when these assemblers could also produce high philosophy, literature, and science? In a world that doesn't grow anymore in terms of population and economy, that is technologically advanced, how can this world formulate a new relation to labor? When growth, development in your work, your discipline is separated from economic growth, will craftsmanship in the making of things be reevaluated? What about a table that can last a generation instead of 5 to 10 years? What could a piece of master craftsmanship be besides an expensive luxury product? Does a master carpenter have just as valuable knowledge as a professor? Why couldn't we treat these kinds of knowledge equally? Isn't the knowledge that is embedded in the body, in the tangible, just as valuable as knowledge of the head, of abstraction, theoretical depth, and critical analysis? Perhaps we need incubators, hotspots, broedplaatsen, for the hand and not for the head. How can workshops, ateliers, guilds, and crafts play a contemporary role in urban culture? How can we regain making? And how can not the mobile knowledge worker, but the rooted manual laborer help the city? How can our cities, societies, bodily intelligence, the homo faber, be revived? Thank you.
Who haven't been up here yet, this right hand side, it's an image of the machine you're looking, or of the mock-up of the actual machine that is being built at the moment. Thank you. I was wondering, I'm trying to relate everything to everything now, but if you look at Hans's distinction he made between visions and utopias, are you maybe saying that we've been dominated now in the last few decades more by visionary leaders and managers? I'm thinking of like the Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerbergs, who are very visionary, and they build these fantastic machines without thinking about their implications. So maybe we're lacking in utopias, or they are lacking. Do we need more utopias in that sense?
I wouldn't be so quick to say we need more utopias, but I think this is kind of beautifully put forward in Adam Curtis's latest documentary, All Machines Were Taught by Loving Grace, where he sort of shows that this kind of cybernetic dream, which was also partly this inspiration for constant cybernetics, which could make like a society in a kind of self-managing, self-organizing organism, and we wouldn't need kind of some to define an ideology and to build it, but it kind of regulate itself. Of course, this is very much also an inspiration for the kind of managerial class. I mean, as long as you run the machine of society efficient, it will tend to equilibrium, everybody will be happy. If you see where this kind of machine is going, because it would say that our capitalist free market society is programmed on efficiency, on growth, on like profit maximization. And so it needs this growth paradigm function. So this is the interesting thing, I think. I mean, what we're interested in, so what if this kind of basic premise of this machine growth, kind of in some of these, especially the economic and the demographic one, starts to fall away, parts of this machine will start to break down. And so in a sense, this kind of ideology, we also of course live in an ideology, but this ideology has become kind of invisible, it's kind of a subconscious ideology. It's not like articulated with propaganda, or it's not like put down
from the state upon us, but of course we live in a system, and the system has certain rules and values embedded in it.
But are you saying that we should unplug, so no more visions and no more utopias?
Well,
put a step aside and think about it for some minutes, maybe.
Yeah, and because, I don't know, if we don't unplug it, or if we don't start tinkering on this machine, it will grind to a halt, or it will run off this nice little cliff with this projection of disaster slides, kind of. So, because if we just keep this machine running as is, this is how it will run. So, yeah.
Hopefully it will run a bit more, because after the break we have four more people coming on stage who will be showing some of the things that they've been working on, and maybe they can tell us whether they're visionaries or utopians or dystopians or none of them. And I will bring my magic machine to the table as well. So we have a 10-minute break, so you can follow that.